This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
A warm welcome to all inquisitive minds around the globe. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Ice Radio, the program where we ask who we are, where we come from, and where we are going. And while we are going, wherever we are going, we're trying to examine the process of the human experience and the dynamics that it entails. What has really been going on this planet? That is the question. History as propaganda, education as manipulation, and interference or disruption, both from idiotic individuals and nefarious organizations, seems to have been the name of the game for a long time. And so what we are trying to do here is work towards a position where one can be set free of constraints, preconceived ideas, to think clearly and find one's own truth, where one can grow and have an open mind yet remain skeptical and take everything with a grain of salt. I think that the value of Red Ice is really when you take the whole rather than the parts. What that means is that contrasting and even opposing positions on the information that we present is what creates a very interesting situation where the listener is not simply being spoon-fed what to believe or think, as in the mainstream media, but is encouraged to think for themselves, question, evaluate, and come to one's own conclusions. Jan Irvin is back on the program today. He is an independent researcher, author, and lecturer, speaking at both academic and public venues. He is the host of Gnostic Media and the curator of the official website for Gian Marco Allegro. He's with us today to discuss his latest research on Gordon Wasson, the influential New York banker and seen by some as the godfather of the modern psychedelic movement. In this two-hour program, Jan shares his findings, which points to the possibility of a secret history of the magic mushroom that connects with the elite power structure, questioning the inceptions of both the psychedelic hippie movement and the New Age movement as a potential psyop. Irving talks about how the mushroom and other mind-altering sacraments can be used to control the illumination of the masses, a form of mind control on a grand scale. Also, before we kick off the program here, Jan has provided you with some reference links where you can go to get more information and follow along as we go through some of the material. Easiest way to do this is simply to go to redicecreations.com, click into our program with Jan, and check under relevant links to access the files, these links, and the so-called brains that we'll be talking about here today. All right, here we go. All right, welcome back, Jan Irvin. Good to talk to you again. Thank you for coming on the program. Everything good with you?
Everything's great, Henrik, and thanks for having me back. I really wanted to have you do this interview because I think it was back in 2007 or 2008 that you had done what was really the first interview with me on this topic, Gordon Wasson, that we'll be delving into today, and the history of magic mushrooms. And, you know, going back 4 or 5 years, I listened to it recently and I thought it was a fantastic interview. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to help me bring this information out. And as well as I've got a database that people can follow along with will give a visual presentation of what we're talking about, some primary documents that I haven't released before that I've got here, a few prime ones that I've selected out of about 1,000 pages of material. And combined, when we combine the Wasson material with, I think it was my last interview with you, I think I've been on your show 4 or 5 times, but the last interview we talked about the Trivium, I believe.
That's right.
Right. So when we combine the Trivium information with this Gordon Wasson information, pretty much the whole story of how they're running this operation begins to unfold. And so this is actually how I began piecing these things together, is learning the Trivium. And I had already started working on this, investigating what had happened to John Allegro's work that we discussed before. But nobody had really ever dug into Wasson's background and done the research and gotten the primary documentation to find out really what he was all about. And any time that anybody submitted an honest request to Harvard University for this type of information, they were denied.
Yep.
So
yep.
I figured out that there were or are two sides to every conversation, and that Harvard and Wasson's family could only control one side, and that it was my supposition at the time that if I went to other universities and in other archives at the time, I could find other people, intelligence people, banking families, elites that Wasson was associated with, search through those archives and find their record of those conversations. So this is the process that I went through doing for a couple of years until I gathered together the box that I have sitting beside me of material. And so it really paints a fascinating picture of the history of magic mushrooms, of the history of the psychedelic movement. And most importantly, it gives us a window into how the elites really run their mind control systems. And so, you know, I just think it's wonderful to be on your show and give you the opportunity, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to present it on your show as well.
Definitely, Jan. Thank you for that. This is a very interesting history, an incredibly important one, of course, because we don't hear the other side of the argument too much, and you've done a great work digging this out. And first of all, I want to reference people to GnosticMedia.com. And if you're listening in the future, it might not be there on the front page, but currently it's there on the front page. Just scroll down to podcast number 144. Magic Mushrooms and the Psychedelic Revolution, Beginning a New History, or The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms. And Jan, as you said, I mean, we talked back in 2008 about this a little bit. This is, I think, some of the aspects that you still have in the Holy Mushroom book, correct? I mean, you've been doing this for quite a while now.
Right. Well, it was writing... Well, see, originally, it was back in 2006 that I was writing an article with Michael Hoffman, Gordon Wasson and John Allegro on the Tree of Knowledge as Amanita. And during that article, I started seeing all of these contradictions. And so while we were writing that article, I decided to take all of Allegro's references to psychedelics or entheogens throughout his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, which I'm now the publisher of, by the way, and I work with his daughter, who's my editor. But I decided to take all of Allegro's citations and just line them up one by one, and then what he said in the book, and then I tracked down the original citations in all of the different books and things that he referenced, and I got those, and I read those, and I laid those all out. And when I read through them all, it told a very, very different story than all of the attacks and lies that were made up against Allegro and his work. So I published that as my book, The Holy Mushroom, A Critical Reevaluation of the Schism Between John Allegro and R. Gordon Wasson Over the Amanita Muscaria, or Over the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, or whatever, something like that. It's hard to remember the titles of your own books after a while. But so, you know, everything in that book was based on primary documentation. It's totally airtight. It's irrefutable. Nobody, academic or otherwise, and I've gotten a couple of very positive academic write-ups on the book, but including published in journals. But nobody has been able to contend it with primary documentation against it on any level. And so it was writing that book and going through that whole investigation against Allegro that I really began to question Wasson's background. And I suppose it was sometime during 2007 that it dawned on me, looking at all of this, these little fragments that were starting to come together, that Wasson was possibly working for the other side. And so, you know, let me just, for instance, read you a letter that the CIA sent me directly. This is from the CIA archives, and I filed a FOIA request with them, a Freedom of Information Act request. Mm-hmm. And this is Wasson's secretary writing to Alan Dulles. This is June 3, 1960. Dear Mr. Dulles, your letter to Mr. Wasson of June 2 arrived after he left for Mexico on his holiday. He does not return to New York until July 11, but I shall inform him about it at the first opportunity. And, you know, here's a letter from April 3, 1957. This is from Alan Dulles to Gordon Wasson. Dear Gordon, it was a great pleasure to write a letter of recommendation on behalf of my good friend Ellsworth Bunker for the Century Association. I have enclosed a copy. It was good to hear from you. Let me know if you are in Washington. Sincerely, Alan Dulles.
Sounds like pretty good friends there.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, so, you know, we're told this whole story that Wasson, you know, forgot who had attempted to contact him about working, whether it was the CIA or FBI. But I've got almost 1,000 pages or probably more than 1,000 pages of material here that show him as a vice president of PR or public relations or propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank, and his conversations between the CIA, between various university professors and researchers on what they're going to write and publish in books and what they're going, how they're going to present things so that the public is brainwashed and controlled.
Absolutely amazing. Now, yeah, carry on, John, because I don't want to interrupt you. I do want to go back to some of the things you've dug out, of course, and have in the podcast. But go ahead first there, John.
Well, this is from March 29, 1957. And, of course, the launching of the Magic Mushrooms was done on May 13th, 1957, which was the day that I put out my piece on Wasson, which is found on the Gnostic Media website. And so this is from Gordon to Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, and it's written on J.P. Morgan letterhead, and it says, "Dear Alan, our fellow member Sidney Davison has proposed Ellsworth Bunker for membership in the Century, meaning the Century Club, and I have seconded his proposal. I think you know Ellsworth, and if so, perhaps you would like to write a supporting letter to the Committee on Admission." See, it appears... I've been investigating this Century Club, and I've been, even the librarian at the Century Club has sent me a lot of documentation, has been very helpful helping me piece together a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And, but it appears that from the 1930s into at least the 1970s or 80s, the Century Club was a front for the CIA. And Alan Dulles himself giving approval for who became members of the CIA. And Gordon Wasson was a high-level person there. Gordon Wasson himself, in fact, nominated George Keenan to the Century Club. And I've got the letters here of that nomination. And so, you know, and in fact, part of those letters are published on the episode for 144. And in fact, let me just pull that up here real quick. I think people will appreciate that. But here's a letter from Foreign Affairs letterhead, R. Gordon Wasson, 23 Wall Street, New York. "Dear Gordon, I have written these Century members to say that you and I are proposing George Keenan for membership." And then get this. "Boris Bankmetev, Charles Burlingham, Alan W. Dulles, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Philip C. Jessup, Gerald Tanqueray Robinson, William Shire, Dean Acheson, James Conant, Edward Mead Earl, Herbert Elliston, Joseph Grew, William Langer, Robert Lovett." And then there's some others on here like John Foster Dulles, Russell Leffingwell, Vannevar Bush, John C. Cooper, and a number of others on another page here. Mm-hmm. And so... you know, what they're doing is they've taken this art society called the Century Club, and they've created a front where they're all having all of these meetings, right?
A way they can socialize, get together, talk about stuff, and it's under the guise of just being an art club, basically, yeah.
Exactly, right? So they're going to this club, they're doing all of this stuff, having all of these meetings. I've got all of these letters that reveal, and I mean, you know, but the letters on the Century Club and all of these intelligence people is incredible. And in fact, the librarian of the Century Club sent me a list of the people who were Sentry members, who were OSS, Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA.
Right.
And there were several hundred people on it that were members of the Sentry Club as well. And so, you know, here is this whole overlap of this key place. Now, let me get into who were some of the members of the Sentry Club. And this, you know, people can follow along up on the WebBrain link that we're sharing with people on the Brain database, the web version. Up on the top right above Gordon Wasson, people will see the Sentry Club there. And clicking on that, that'll take us to where the Sentry Club is in the center there. And we see that the Council on Foreign Relations and Stanford White created the Sentry Club. And interestingly, if we look below the Sentry Club, we see that Alan Dulles, Austin Armstrong, B.H. Friedman, who is another psychedelic researcher, they're all there, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Dwight Morrow, Edmund Williamson, but there's Frank Alshul, George Keenan there. All these people are members of the Sentry Club. And interestingly, we see an offshoot below there of the Sentry Club, which is the Bohemian Club.
Mm-hmm.
The Bohemian Club came out of the Sentry Club. It is a direct offshoot of the Sentry Club. It's the West Coast version of the Sentry Club. Now, both of them are really journalist societies. And I guess these high-level elitist journalists, they form these groups so that they can bring all these elitists in and work together with them on how they're going to propagandize the public. And so the Bohemian Club is there, and if we go down a level into the Bohemian Club, we see, you know, Henry S. Morgan and Charles F. Morgan as members there, who were the sons of Wasson's boss at J.P. Morgan Bank. And Wasson, again, was the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank.
Now, Jan, I don't want to jump. It's very interesting. Let's not jump ahead here, though. Let's bring potential newcomers to this also up to speed here. Just
sure.
Give us a little bit of background on Gordon Wasson and why we're talking about him in this context right now.
Okay, so Gordon Wasson, the reason why he's important is he discovered, quote unquote, and this is besides the thousands of indigenous Native Americans and Mexicans who had already used them for thousands of years, but he, quote unquote, discovered magic mushrooms and popularized them in Henry Luce's publication. Henry Luce was the owner of Time Life magazines.
Yep.
And so Wasson, on May 13, 1957, published a series, Seeking the Magic Mushroom, that was that launched the popularizing of magic mushrooms. And in fact, it was because of Wasson's article on magic mushrooms, it is said that Timothy Leary, and everybody at Harvard is dirty, so at least everybody that I've come across is dirty. So, I can't say that this story is really true, but supposedly Timothy Leary discovered Wasson's article in Life magazine, and that's what got him to travel down to Oaxaca, Mexico. He tried mushrooms and then became the guru of LSD and popularized LSD. What people don't realize, though, is that Henry Luce is actually credited as the main person who popularized LSD, and Henry Luce was well known for using LSD as well, and Henry Luce was a member of Skull and Bones, as were most of the original founders of Time Life Magazine Incorporated. And so, so here's this guy, Luce, who actually Timothy Leary himself learned about these drugs from. Okay, so Leary learned about the psychedelics from Luce, if we can believe any of the story at all, mm-hmm. that the official story. But interestingly, if we go to, and going back to, there's a link in the top left, if people click that, that'll take us back to the Gordon Wasson on the front page there. And below the Sentry Club, we'll see the Council on Foreign Relations there. And Gordon Wasson was a chairman to the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as chairman to several meetings there. And Alan Dulles was a director of the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as the CIA. And as we just saw, he was the one of the head approving members of the Century Club. So other people that were in charge of the Council on Foreign Relations include Cecil Rhodes, Colonel Edward M. House, David Rockefeller, Francis Cardinal Spellman, J.P. Morgan, John Foster Dulles, and Paul Warburg, some of these other people, Theodore Shackley, these all tie in there. And interestingly, some of the names that I've already mentioned are below that are agents there. And we see George F. Keenan, he's a member there. George Soros is a member there. And of course, George Soros has been behind funding PR, one of the offshoots of the Center for Media and Democracy, banking part of it, right?
Yep.
And so, in my opinion, he's creating a controlled opposition, just like George Soros funded the medical marijuana movement here in California. And by funding the medical marijuana movement, the hemp movement stopped cold. And so I think that was controlled opposition. Give people medical marijuana to get everybody to stop fighting for industrial hemp.
Oh boy.
And so, also members of the Council on Foreign Relations there, we see Arthur Aschel, C.D. Jackson. Now, C.D. Jackson was vice president of Time Life magazine. He was also at Buchenwald in charge of mind control operations there. He was in charge of, he's the one who bought the JFK assassination Zapruder film and stored it away for decades at Time Life magazines, along with Henry Luce. Now, C.D. Jackson, Henry Luce, and all of these guys are very much suspected to have been involved in the JFK assassination. We see Frank Wisner there, Frank Aschel. Again, there's Henry Luce. We see Kroll Incorporated. Osama bin Laden is under there. But, there's Timothy Geithner. There's a guy, Townsend Hoops, who might be the grandfather of Professor John Hupps at Kansas University. Averill Harriman is in there. Walter Lippmann is in there. All these guys tie into the Council on Foreign Relations. But so here's Gordon Wasson. He is one of these guys, and he was working with Aschel and Alan Dulles and Keenan at the Century Club all along. Now, one letter that I have here from George Keenan, and I didn't check the date on it. I apologize for that, but this is from Harvard University Archives. Somebody snuck it out for me. I want to thank you once more for your loyal collaboration and many kindnesses during these past years. Aside from all our common trials and problems, I have immensely enjoyed the friendship and hope that the future will give us opportunity to renew our associations. So, this is George Keenan. He's former OSS intelligence ambassador to the USSR. And if we follow George Keenan in the map there below the Council on Foreign Relations, we'll see that he was involved in Operation Mockingbird, Operation Paperclip, bringing Nazis into the U.S. He was involved in the Marshall Plan, as well as the JFK assassination. So now I have a letter here from, this is a very interesting letter, and here is Gordon trying to recruit George Keenan to the CIA after the OSS has been dissolved, and how Gordon would know that Keenan was being recruited for the CIA must mean that Gordon himself is a very high level official in the CIA itself, because Gordon is the one trying to recruit this guy, right? Mm. And so this is from April, it looks like, it could be April 1st or 5th, possibly April 5th, 1953. Dear Gordon, thank you for your note of Good Friday. I was much interested in what you had said about the CIA, and in the many ways would welcome the opportunity to work with Alan Dulles, who has been throughout extremely kind to me. But on balance, I feel I would rather take a break, a clean one at that, at this time. Bolian's expression or experience was so shocking that a great many foreign service officers, including numbers of those services that have not like my own, been rejected by the new secretary, have a strong desire to make themselves independent of the government at the earliest possible moment. I feel that way myself. I reflect furthermore that if Mr. Dulles and the president were not able to use my contributions directly, in other words, he's saying I do not want to be an agent, but I will work for you directly, for the president and for the director of the CIA. Mm-hmm. And he's telling this directly to Gordon Wasson. They will not be much, if they were not able to use my contributions directly, they will not be much more apt to have use for them indirectly, in other words, as an agent. Finally, I question whether it is in the public interest that every ex-ambassador to Moscow should proceed directly from that position, either to intelligence work or to committees set up to overthrow the USSR. And then it continues from there. But clearly, beyond any doubt, Wasson is intelligence working with the head of the CIA. Now, I've had some really interesting attacks from some people on this work, and I do want to get into those. Now, Christopher Knowles, who's the author of The Secret History of Rock and Roll, I believe is the title of his book, he attacked my work. He said that Lyndon LaRouche had come to the same conclusions 30 years ago. I want to say that I've never read Lyndon LaRouche at all. Chris went on to say that I copied and pasted directly from Lyndon LaRouche when I asked him for quotes and citations to back up his claims. He refused to give me any and said that I was being crazy and I was giving up all of my research and going in a really bad direction and that I had just stolen everything from LaRouche. In fact, I never read anything from LaRouche. I've gotten my documents from Yale, from Columbia University, from the Hoover Institute, from the CIA archives directly, from the CFR archives at Princeton University, Hoover Institute at Stanford, all these different universities, including UC Santa Barbara and the Century Club itself. This is where I've gotten my documentation. So I still have not read Lyndon LaRouche, if in fact he and I did come to the same conclusions through completely different means, that says a lot in and of itself. And I have no connection whatsoever, period, with Lyndon LaRouche. Other attackers against the work, and nearly all of the people who attacked it, including Christopher Knowles, actually refused to read my article in full or check any of the citations. Another person who I thought created a really interesting attack against the work was Chris Bennett, who's a very famous cannabis researcher and used to work on Pot TV and all of this stuff. And he and I have been friends for years, but he attacked us saying because there was one possible mistake, and I think it's a fallacy of equivocation on this other author's part, and it's ambiguous if he's talking about this guy that Wasson worked with, Peterkin, or if he's talking about Wasson himself, and whether or not Wasson or if it was Peterkin who couldn't remember which pope that Wasson had worked with. It bears nothing on the conclusion of the article. But Chris Bennett hung on this one point for a week and refused to read the rest of the article and says that, oh, your article is so full of errors. I asked him to quote me any, and he couldn't. None. And there's been other researchers who've said that my conclusions may not be supported by the article. Every one of them, when I've asked them for the citations or quotes that, of things that don't support my conclusions, not one single person has come through. And other attacks against the work have been, I sound like a lunatic because I no longer believe that psychedelics can enlighten and evolve people on their own. When it's clear, when you go through this, through these documents, that the entire psychedelic movement has been a psyop all along, and that stage two really didn't even begin until Terrence and Dennis McKenna figured out how to grow magic mushrooms at home in their book, Magic Mushroom Grower Guide by whatever aughts, you know, they created a pseudonym that they wrote it under. And until that book was published, nobody knew how to grow magic mushrooms. So that's really after the MK Ultra trials of the 1970s. That's really when stage two of the entire PSYOP takes off, this whole new age version that they've created out of the Esalen Institute up in Big Sur, Northern California. So the whole new age movement, the UFO stuff, the psychedelic stuff, the tying it all together with Eastern religion and all of this stuff, all of this comes out of the Esalen Institute. And so,
now,
go ahead.
No, I want to ask you a little bit more about that. Now, is there a way for those, again, then, who haven't, you know, up to speed about all this, can you summarize some of your other conclusions here? I mean, these are big points, and we're going to get into them, but is there anything else that is important to hear about your conclusions, Jan?
About my conclusions in the attacks against my work,
More at the conclusions you have so far come to pertaining to the work you've done on Wasson and his connections, obviously. Okay. Here's
the main conclusion that I've come to, and you know this has been a hard experience for me because I used to believe that you know if we could just give everybody a full blown psychedelic experience, we could enlighten everybody and this crap would end.
Okay. Yeah. But,
I've since discovered, and Marlene Dobkin de Rios talked about this in some of her work, as well as Professor Neil Whitehead, who died in March this year, who was an expert on dark shamanism. He's pretty much one of the only people talking about it. It's really whitewashed and hidden. But there's this whole aspect to psychedelics that is used for mind control. And when a person is in a peak experience, if they do not have critical thinking, like the trivium, like you and I discussed last time, then it's very easy to reprogram. So they reprogram that person. So let's say they do 5 to 7 grams of mushrooms in silent darkness with a sitter, and they have a full-blown out-of-body experience. Well, when they come down, if they don't have a systematic method for fact-checking reality, like the trivium, then what happens? Well, you'll break free from the traditional dogmatic religions. But what they've done is they've set up this entire secondary catch web, the New Age movement, the psychedelic movement, the 2012 movement, you know, Daniel Pinchbeck stuff, all of this kind of stuff is all set there as a second catch web to catch everybody and ensnare them into this whole psychological mind control operation. That may seem a bit crazy and out there, but I do have thousands of primary documents showing how MK Ultra is active today. The program never ended as most people think it did.
Yeah,
I think that the evidence, the documentation that I have found shows that the entire operation is still active and what they've done. And, you know, when you get in and study that trivium, like you and I went into last time, you can see how they manipulate with the fallacies and dialectics and controlled opposition and all of that stuff. And through the trivium, all of that unravels. And the trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Grammar answers who, what, where, and when. Logic answers why. Rhetoric answers how. And what they've done is they've gotten everybody to put their logic before their grammar, to try and answer why something is before they've ever asked who, what, where, and when. And so this is a very easy way to control people and dumb them down, is because whenever somebody puts why before who, what, where, when, they'll accept whatever information from some authority is given them, whether it's the news, some guy in a costume like a white coat or a policeman's uniform or a government official costume, a judge costume, etc. And then they buy into all of these, you know, appeal to authority fallacies. And so this is, you know, part of the whole a dumbing down process. Now, the conclusion is that the conclusion is that they've figured out a really easy way to get even the hippies and the former rebels of the 60s, etc., under complete control using positive thinking. And like Dr. Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. Whenever any real information comes up, they've gotten the hippies to pillow sit and start positive thinking and say, oh, that's negative, I won't deal with that. And this is how they've taken over and controlled everything, to sum it up.
Very interesting. I want to hear more about this. Now, there is, we need to, let's talk a little bit about the myth around Wasson. I know you do a great job at digging into a little bit to this. I want to ask you about the archives. When you contacted them at Harvard, allegedly they have a temple even for Wasson right there. But I guess all of it begins the story about the walk through the woods, right? That's back in, what, 1927, I believe?
That's correct. Yeah, the whole story is based on Wasson's supposed walk in the woods in 1927 with his wife, Valentina Pavlovna. And let me just pull that up here. In 1927, Wasson and his wife, and here's the official story as published in Life magazine from May 13, 1957. And this is how the whole damn thing begins. It was a walk in the woods many years ago that launched my wife and me on our quest of the mysterious mushroom. We were married in London in 1926, she being Russian, born and brought up in Moscow. She had lately qualified as a physician at the University of London. I am from Great Falls, Montana, of Anglo-Saxon origins. In the late summer of 1927, recently married, we spent our holiday, notice he says holiday, not honeymoon, in the Catskill Mountains in the New York State. In the afternoon of the first day, we went strolling along a lovely mountain path through the woods crisscrossed by the slanting rays of the descending sun. We were young, carefree, and in love. Suddenly, my bride abandoned my side. She had spied wild mushrooms in the forest, and racing over the carpet of dried leaves in the woods. You know, it just sounds, it's too overworked, and it's... It's too story-like, right? like you're reading a novel. Running over the carpet of dried leaves in the woods, she knelt in poses of adoration before first one cluster of these growths, one cluster and then another of these growths. In ecstasy, she called each kind by an endearing Russian name. She caressed the toadstools, savored their earthly perfume. Like all good Anglo-Saxons, and here's the no good Scotsman fallacy here, I knew nothing about the fungal world and felt that the less I knew about those putrid, treacherous excrescences, the better. For her, they were things of grace, infinitely inviting to the perceptive mind. She insisted on gathering them, laughing at my protests, mocking my horror. She brought a skirtful back to the lodge. She cleaned and cooked them. That evening, she ate them alone. Not long married, I thought to wake up a widower the next morning. These dramatic circumstances, puzzling and painful for me, made a lasting impression on us both. From that day on, we sought an explanation for this strange cultural cleavage separating us in a minor area of our lives. Now, this story, and this is the official story. Even Wasson's daughter has questioned this story, right? And so Wasson writes in The Sacred Mushroom Seeker, published by Thomas Riedlinger, "As much as I respected my father's integrity, I recall that for years I did not believe him when he said that his interest in mushrooms began on his honeymoon in 1927. Such an explanation seemed to me like a Hollywood soap opera, something out of character for my father. Eventually, however," and this is an added caveat notice, "eventually, however, I concluded that the story was true, for he told it sincerely and consistently." So what she's saying is that if someone BS's you sincerely and consistently enough, that you should accept the lie.
Right.
Right? That's what she's saying right there. And so, but there's more to it. You know, Andy Letcher, the author of Shroom, he also came to the same conclusion that the story was false. And, you know, everybody who's attacked me on these points, not one of them has laid out the evidence that I put forth here correctly. And, you know, Chris Bennett and the others have all taken these points completely out of context because they didn't even read the article when they tried to attack it. It's just so typical of putting logic before grammar. And you know, here's Andy Letcher. He says, "It must be said that this hoary old story has become something of a foundational myth for modern mushroom enthusiasts. It was repeated by Wasson ad infinitum and grew ever taller in the telling. Its growing resemblance to a Hollywood movie script made Wasson's own daughter, Masha, question whether it had any substance at all. But eventually she conceded that the incident had genuinely occurred, however embroidered the story had become over the years. This is itself telling, for, as we shall see, Wasson had a knack of overworking dry empirical facts in the interests of a good story. And I think that Letcher here is missing the entire point that Wasson was the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the bigger thing is that we'll get into here in a few minutes is that Wasson and Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda, hung out together often for at least a decade.
That's right. They lived close by to each other too, didn't they?
I haven't looked at that. But in the U.S. Library of Congress is a document written by Bernays himself discussing his relationship with Wasson. And we'll get back to that here in a little bit. But, you know, another thing that's not talked about is this major coincidence problem that we have with the Wasson story and just buying it at face value. And again, like I said, all of these points that I've laid out in the article have been omitted by all of the attackers, but Valentina did her own write-up on their mushroom experiences in Oaxaca, Mexico, and her article was timed for publication that same week as Wasson's article. Wasson's was published again on May 13th, 1957. Valentina's was published in This Week magazine on May 19, 1957.
Hmm.
Now, nowhere do they talk about how they got this done. You know, when Wasson talks about how he got his article published in Life magazine, he only mentions a chance meeting with the editor of the magazine, which we'll get into more here in a moment. But so Valentina's was published in This Week magazine, and it went out to approximately 12 million newspaper subscribers the same week as Wasson's.
Yeah, wow. So it's like they're dropping this at the same time, obviously, and to get it out there into the mass consciousness.
To get it out as far as possible into the mass consciousness, and they're, one of the other attackers is, oh, well, this is all blowback and the elites are all doing everything for our good. Well, I'm looking at all of this stuff, folks, and I see eugenics throughout it. You know, Aldous Huxley, his brother Julian Huxley, tied to MI6 and the major eugenics programs. Aldous Huxley was very clearly in favor of the eugenics programs, as his work talks about. I think that Huxley's book, and in fact, I've got a letter here. I think Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, where he talks about soma. Remember, Wasson later wrote a book that soma was the red Amanita muscaria mushroom. I don't think that that's any coincidence.
Yeah.
Here's a letter dated from George Keenan to Gordon Wasson on December 18, 1956. Reverting to your talk at this Philological Society, I assume you are familiar with Aldous Huxley's little book, The Doors of Perception, which just came out into my hands. If so, please do not trouble to answer this. If not, then I am sure it would interest you. But and we'll get back to Aldous Huxley here in a little bit when we go back to the brain database.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to find the other citation here.
Sure, no worries. If you want to, while you're thinking about that, if it's possible, can you just give us a little background on Valentina Pavlovna? You mentioned she was, she wasn't just the regular farm girl from Russia, if you know what I mean, right?
Right, and that's the issue is that and one researcher, this guy Caleb Smith, he's a researcher up in Northern California, attacked the piece saying that I said that Valentina, her family was KGB. Nowhere did I say that whatsoever. That was his own error and his own misreading of page 4 of Mushrooms, Russia, and History. But Valentina was a child who grew up in Moscow of the Russian intelligentsia. And it looks like there's some ties there. She might be a second or third generation down from the princess of, the Tsar's princess of Russia. And so there's this link there and possibly why she fled off into London to get her doctor's degree and all of this stuff, right?
Right.
During the slaughtering of the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution. And so, she's tied into all of this Russian intelligentsia, and she claims that she spent her holidays out in her summers out in the woods at this place, and that they would go out picking mushrooms. But, the story is as a young girl, and she had to have left Moscow by the time she was 14 to go to London and start medical school. And so the story doesn't add up, and the elites, they are trained in the trivium and the Ivy League schools. So it's not that she couldn't have started studying medicine at that point, but it's that the background story of her remembering all of these mushroom names from young childhood and then being able to spot them in the United States and New York and have this whole dance about them. It just seems really odd. And, I know a lot of things about childhood. I've never run off, and it just doesn't quite add up. And seeing that she grew up in Moscow in a city and would have only had vacation time to study these things, it just, to me, there's just too many questions there.
In your view, Jan, is the whole story bunkin' made up, or is there some elements of truth in it? Very difficult to say, of course.
I mean, Andy Letcher might be right. There might be a small element of truth to it. But, if it's just a psyop that they made up, I don't think it really matters.
No, of course not. No.
But, Valentina's, going back to Valentina's write-up in This Week magazine, it just so happens that This Week magazine was published by Joseph P. Knapp, who, get this, just happened to be director of Morgan's Guarantee Trust, where Wasson began working for Morgan in 1928 or 1934. How is it that, the other issue, Life magazine, one of the founders of Life magazine was a guy by the name of Henry P. Davison, who was Wasson's director or boss at J.P. Morgan.
Yeah. There you go.
Dwight Morrow. Mm-hmm. Dwight Morrow was another, there's several of these guys that were skull and bones and were behind the founding of Life magazine and tied directly to J.P. Morgan. So Wasson's boss at J.P. Morgan was Henry P. Davison Jr. Davison was a senior partner there. Davison funded the creation of Time Life magazine in 1923. And Davison and Luce both graduated skull and bones together from Yale University. They were both initiated in 1920. And C.D. Jackson, former head of U.S. psychological warfare, was brought in there. And then they've got this guy, Britton Hayden, who worked with Morrow and Luce and Davison. These guys were all skull and bones that set up Time Life. Mm-hmm. And anybody can check this stuff out. This stuff is well published now, thanks to Charlotte Iserbit and Anthony Sutton and these people up at, Anthony Sutton was up at the Hoover Institute, which just so happens to be where I got a lot of my information from on this research.
Yeah.
And so, here's all of these tie-ins. Okay, we have the May 1957 publication of the Life magazine and This Week magazine articles, both tied together, both published by different directors of J.P. Morgan, both different, people that Wasson worked with. Both of them coming out at the same time, both of them hitting millions of people at the same time. Okay, then we have all of the letters that I already went through showing the ties between Alan Dulles and Wasson directly between each other, even right, days, weeks before the Life magazine article came out. Okay, we have all of the connections there. I don't have a connection that says, here's the conspiracy that we're doing it, other than, and I just mentioned the Hoover Institute. let me read you this series of letters. And this is something that, and there's probably, I've got a few more here than I published in the article, which will appear in the book, but Bertram Wolf, he's a Russian researcher that basically converted and came to help the U.S. And he and Wasson would have occasional conversations. And he writes Wasson on October 8, 1970. And Wasson had just written this article in the New York Times, creating this whole big sob story about Oaxaca, Mexico, and what he had done to the people there and his popularizing and everything. And, you know, Bob, Jesse, and others have said, you know, my work is wrong because, you know, Wasson published that 1970 article showing his remorse. Mm-hmm. Well, it's bunk. October 8, 1970. Dear Mr. Wasson, I was greatly interested in your article in the New York Times on the sacred mushroom. I marked your note of sadness near the end and wish to tell you that you have nothing to reproach yourself for. Knowledge will out. If one man does not spread it, another will. The hippies, peddlers, and dogberries will end, for nature abhors a vacuum. You may have hastened it a little by publishing in Life rather than in a magazine of anthropologists, but the process was inevitable. And it's interesting now that this group of people, and going back to Aldous Huxley, they created the hippies and everything that they then hate and despise. It's like that quote from Sir Thomas More that I believe I read on your last show, but I'll read it again. Let me just pull it up here. For if you, the rulers, suffer your people to be ill-educated and for their manners to be corrupted from their infancy, and then punish them for those crimes to which their first education disposed them, what else could be concluded from this but that you first make thieves and outlaws and then punish them? And that's from his book Utopia, Book 1, from the 1500s. Mm-hmm. And so Wasson replies to Bertrand Wolf on October 13, 1970, Dear Mr. Wolf, do you remember your last letter to me? I was asking you where Tolstoy had said that the printing press was a mighty engine for disseminating ignorance. This Mazatec affair is a case in point. Mm. So, you know, what they're doing here is so crazy on so many different levels, okay? You know, Wasson is in the article, when you read it, the 1970 New York Times piece, he's shedding crocodile tears over this so-called, releasing the information and the mushrooms, while he and Bertram Wolf, they disparage entire groups of people. In the New York Times article, Wasson is just attacking everybody using ad hominem attacks, dismissing entire groups of people and categorizing them and poisoning the well and stuff. I mean, it's just hideous, the things that he says in this article. And it says, let me see if I can, yeah, here's the quote here. The whole of the countryside is agog with the furtive movements of hippies, the comings and goings of the Federalistas, the dogberries, and their blundering efforts to root them out. You know, and he also says, The village has become a true mecca for hippies, psychopaths, adventurers, pseudo-research workers, and the miscellaneous crew of our society's dropouts. Hmm.
So they have, in effect, created this, these people then, on the first level that they kind of, well, they despise what it is, but at the same time, if you know that you're the instigator behind a specific group or, you know, orientation, what have you, it is... far more likely that it's easier to control them from their point of view, right? Or again, is there any follow through on more of the purposes of why they would do this? Because it's a big plan, obviously, to do this.
You know, I think it's, well, you know, they have to launch this psychological warfare operations. So, you know, they're trying to figure out. See, if you go back to the ancient Greek Eleusinian mysteries, or Eleusinian, however it's pronounced. You see there that it's the elites and the government dishing out once in a lifetime a full-blown psychedelic experience to everyone in the population. And so what it is, it's a totally controlled religious system that they're dispensating the drugs through the temple and controlling the whole operation. Okay, mm-hmm. I think we're seeing a copy of this again here. And right now it's like you have groups like MAPS with... Rick Doblin trying to get all of the drugs medicalized. And if you think about, you're going to a psychotherapist, and psychotherapy and psychiatry is completely from head to toe tied up into this operation. And when you get in and you look at this stuff, you see that, you know, what would be the benefit of the government giving psychologists and psychiatrists permission to distribute psychedelic drugs? Oh, well, you know, Big Brother allowed me to have this experience. Oh, they're so wonderful. And I'm just, you know, hooray for the government and this type of thing. And so I think it's a further way to trick people into giving their autonomy away to this false belief in governmental authority or the ad verecundium fallacy. And so I think that's part of it. I think part of it is getting people in this state of positive thinking and, you know, they're well, see, when we get into the Esalen Institute and the MACI conferences, in fact, let's go to the MACI conferences right now in the brain from the Esalen Institute. There's a search down in the bottom left for people to just type that in, and they can pull up the Esalen Institute and MACI conferences, and you'll see them on the same pages together. The MACI conferences essentially created the Esalen Institute, and the MACI conferences also created the MKUltra project. Now, Margaret Mead, the famous anthropologist, never doubted that a small group of people with an idea can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Hmm. Well, she wasn't talking about the hippies, dum-dums. She was talking about the group at the MACI conferences, and including her husband, Gregory Bateson. These guys, these were the thinkers and the movers and shakers behind creating the whole psychedelic movement. Now, the MACI conferences, one of the leading things there is the Tavistock Institute of Human Behavior. We've got Norbert Wiener working there. We've got Lawrence K. Frank working there. Kurt Lewin, who's a big player in the MK Ultra operations, working there. And John von Neumann. And, you know, so one of the ideas that they created at the MACI conference was this. They wanted to sell this idea of the world citizen.
Right.
Imagine yeah. all the people, right?
Right.
So, and so we get this whole, you know, this whole idea, let's get rid of the borders. Let's get rid of our sovereignty and our autonomy. Let's subject everything to the Rothschilds and the Jewish New World Order. And let's go from there. So, you know, this is really how they are getting the counterculture under control. Okay, so when we going back to the Esalen Institute, the Esalen Institute is really fascinating. And this is when we get into like Huxley and Michael Murphy, Dick Price. Well, Richard Price or Dick Price and Michael Murphy, they're the so-called founders of the Esalen Institute.